Hystrepis 2. When I got home a day or so later, I found my place empty, and I still had not yet slept in our bed since it all. And I seen that Sam's Molly Beth had cleared out my Maybelle's dresses from the closet, and I was glad of that, because it made me so sad to see him. I just couldn't even look in there. I dreaded taking out my suitcase for the last trip. I was glad it was empty now, putting it back in place on the floor of the closet. But still, I had to have a little cry even so. It being empty made me feel emptied and full of longing for her. And then I wanted to go see my daughter. I took the trolley out of Dale and Selby and out past the farm campus and through the woods there, through the groves below it, the deep tunnel of yellow and red spangling leaves, next to the crooked creek I could smell, and a hobo's jungle, where I seen the shadowy men peering into steaming buckets of stew I could smell, over small fires I could smell, and their lean, mean dogs, a slinking line of lean, mean dogs after a suffering bitch in heat. But the sky was so blue, so blue, blue as a long note on a sad saxophone. And then looking at it, I did not think on anything for a moment. But I could not help but think. When we, the trolley, rolled out getting faster and faster, rolled out down the hill, suddenly into city, onto the red paving stones and slowed squealing onto the flat of neatly cross-woven red sandstone paving stones on slippering track, gleaming embedded among them. And I seen the brick-built Ukrainian sausage company we shopped at and the Carnegie Library we went to at the riverside, just where the river is to be crossed, like a marble temple. And useless to me as a temple may be, because I can't stand to read anymore, because it's too quiet, and my thoughts run. And I thought of when, I remembered when, back before the war, when we went by this trolley out to Lake Nokomis for to take the paddle boat, the swan-headed paddle boat out where it was cool over the water. And the white overseer did not want to let me pay, refused my money, said there was none, but there was five, and nobody waiting, and looked at you like you was dirt, and I was going to hit him. But you said, it don't matter none, because I'm with you, and that's enough. And she was born 9 months after, or near enough to be the day, to be the very day, I am sure. The trees on Portland Avenue, the elms there, make a lofty Gothic arch over the boulevard, like the vaulted roof of an ancient medieval cathedral. Our Lady of Peace, we ought to know. And Sister Kenny's home for children is there, among the gilded leafy sanctuary. Is there some old mansion of some lumber magnet or flower magnet refitted and repaired to be the hospital for so many, too many children who are dying or crippled or gasping for air because of the polio? And my own Mary Lee, you named her, I had no say, is among them. In an iron lung. In the sunny, warm conservatory where the big palms are fed on broth and warm milk. She's like a stick. She has a face more lovely and warm and chocolate than ever, like her mother's. Brown eyes like yours. Darling, limpid, languorous, kind. I do not know where I get these words. I wished I'd never read a book. I remember words I do not want to know. Sister Kenny says, I must hope. We should always hope. There is always hope. There is God and there is hope. I believe no more in the one than in the other. But I thank God for her, if for no other reason than that my little baby is not in pain, and she can breathe, and it is nothing I could afford myself. I do not know by what miracle it occurred, but Sister Kenny reassures me every time that she's taken care of. Someone has taken care of it. Who, I don't know. And how, she will not say. Haywire was there in the conservatory, dressed like a cowboy, singing with his rosewood guitar to a semicircle of little girls' heads smiling in their six iron lungs. Well, the fog went a-courtin', he did ride a-hum, a-hum. Frog went a-courtin', and he did ride a sword and pistol by his side, a-hum, a-hum, a-hum. He made the croaking sounds and hopped as he played. Girly squeaks of a mouse and scampered, hoots of an owl and flew, and sat like a bumblebee, sits playing a saw on her knees. He pretended this sound with his guitar somehow. How he'd done those things. I was sure surprised, too, and it made Mary Lee laugh. He laughed, too, and all the children laughed. And he left out the last verse, where the snake eats up the wedding. So every day for the next 4 days, I come back and sit with Mary Lee and wash her face and feed her soup and ice cream and sips of water, and we talk. And every day, Haywire is there, too. Always even before I get there, and usually leaves later, and moves all around the place, visiting and singing. And I did not know he knowed so many of them children. But the nurse, she told me, with an admiring smile at him, that he'd been there every day he could, and always brung his guitar. And we had him to thank for the ice cream, too, and for all the iron lungs they got. And that mystified me, because I could not imagine where one could get an iron lung. Wasn't that some specialty item? Not like they was out there in used car lots. So, when on the last day we was going to leave together, because we'd have to hurry and catch the afternoon train, our next run on the Empire Builder, I had intended to penetrate this thing. I feared we'd be late. He dawdled so. But he called a cab. I'd thought to take the trolley, but he said he got a cab all ready for himself. And when it came, the driver seemed to know him. But he called him Mr. Mather. And I thought it odd. But he tipped the man to wait, and I stood with him at the door while he went back and said something quietly to my Mary Lee, bent over close with his cowboy hat in his hands, and Sister Kenny there leaning over her too, her hands on her apron front, scrunched to listen to Mary Lee talking back. Haywire stood up, laughing, and said he was sure it would be just like she said, and he'd hope he could see, and knew it would be soon. He put his hat on and waved to all the children, who all cried out, "Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye," just as sweetly as Munchkins to Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. And we was off. Zoomed up Franklin in the yellow cab. He called the driver Bob, which was his name, short for Robert Johnson on the cab license pinned on the sun visor I seen. And Bob made small talk and called him Mr. Mather, and Haywire leaned over the seat to listen to him until we got to the hilltop near where the Pillsburys live. And there he drove up the driveway to a mansion and into and underneath the stone porch archway connecting to the carriage house. And Haywire jumped out and was greeted by a butler and a cook, dusting flour off her hands onto her apron, who curtsies, I swear to God. And the butler bowed and handed him his suitcase. And it is a grand suitcase. I had always thought it a grand suitcase he carried, some alligator hide or some such, and gold appointments and straps about it like the best of the old-fashioned valises. The cook touched his arm, and he pecked her cheek. "At your mother?" I asked him when he got back in, and he laughed and said he wished it was. And I realized what I said was silly, because, of course, he was older than she was. But that then made the whole mystery more strange. We went off in a skitter of gravel as he had the driver hurry up to get us to the station on time, and cut up along the river road underneath the bluff with the city above until, after a wind through a tiny town on the flats, we climbed out on the backside of the city and threaded the blocks to the Union Station in St. Paul. I jumped out, and he did too, and he didn't pay the driver but thanked him. I went straight off to the commissary, but Haywire went to the train directly. I checked in and found that they had promoted me to second cook. And when I got down to load up the stores where the train had come in and the crews being exchanged, I met my new third cook, and my usual chef grunted at me, and Sam nodded. Some new waiters, too, I seen. Sam asked about Mary Lee, and I said she was doing good, but I did not know that she'd ever walk again. And he shook his head and said Molly Beth would be out to check on her while we was gone, and not to worry. And I said, I ain't worried. I just wish she had not got the polio, what with her mother and all. Life was hard enough on the child. He nodded again and said, what we know about, what will be, we can put in a can and shake, and what we'd hear would be nothing but what we wanted to hear. And that is a fact. Best rely on what is, he said. I nodded, but I wondered if it is ever enough to rely on what is. I said, what happened to Haywire? He looked back and shrugged. And I asked, you think he got fired? He shook his head and let out a gripe at one of the waiters who had obviously come to work drunk and sassy. And then back to me, and he replied, no, I'm sure that ain't so. Not Haywire. Yeah, says I. Then where is he? Just then, of course, Haywire appears above me at the door, where I'm taking produce boxes and eggs and bags of spuds and all the commissary cart, and hefting them up to the deck for the third cook to put away, chef grousing that the kid didn't know what he was doing. And annoyed, I was outside talking with Sam. Haywire, still in his cowboy best, cigarette in his mouth, leans out and asks Sam if he'd washed his hands and winks at him, and then turns back and teases Chef and asks him to set aside the best steak for him. Now, I think everybody knew what I did not know, and I only figured out later that he had quit and for some reason had got himself a Pullman to overnight to Chicago. He would sit by himself in the dining car for most of the night. Sam would not run him off. Sat through all seatings, keeping his booth to himself. Well, not quite by himself. He brung in on his arm these two lovely gals from the coaches on their way to Northwestern College or some such. They was jailbait, or fraternity fodder, I should say. He shared a bottle of Mogan David with them, having taken their complaint about the vintage Burgundy, which they sniffed at and said was bitter. And they was tipsy and giggled when he offered to let them take beds in his Pullman. But they accepted. They took the bottle with him, and he called after to say he'll be there soon. I sat down just then, enjoying the fact that the third cook was now doing dishes that I used to have to have done, and accepted a cigarette from him, though I don't generally smoke, and a glass of Burgundy, though I don't generally drink. And Sam joined us at the table, leaning against the edge of it to brace himself, while the car rocked on the rails, and picked up the tab and put it in his pocket without a word. And Haywire beamed up at him and said, "You're a great man, sir." Sam sauntered off. I had to ask, "So what you doing? You quit?" Haywire shrugged. He poured the rest of the wine into my glass. He said he was on his way to Washington to see some friends. And he sat up earnest and alive with some notion and said, "You know, you ought to come." I said, "I can't do that. I got to work." He said he'd take care of all that and got up and went to the kitchen. And when he came back, Chef was with him, grinning. I don't know what he said, but Chef said, "You go with him to Washington, boy. I can get somebody out of St. Paul on the way back." I worried for my job, but Chef laughed and looked at Haywire and said that weren't no problem. So that is how it happened. And it was from the next day forward like some sort of dream. Like I had been knocked on my head and found myself woke up in a technicolor world. We checked into the Palmer House. Me in my gravy-stained check chef pants, my chef coat. I had at least taken off my cook's hat, but everybody looked at me like I did not belong. And I did not belong. But everyone knew Haywire and greeted him warmly. The doorman took his suitcase with a big grin and asked if he was staying long, and Haywire said, "Not long this time, Bert," and the doorman said he was sorry to hear that. He did not even check in at the front desk, but glanced toward it, where the desk clerk nodded and picked up the house phone to issue some instruction, or so I guessed, because when we got to the penthouse, by a private elevator, we was met by the concierge, a polished young woman in a business suit, with courteous inquiries to which Haywire gave casual, friendly replies. And then he added instructions that she should see to it that I was found a suit from the clothing store in the foyer, and a hat, too, of course. "What size?" he asked me, but before I could reply, she said, 7 3/8, I should think. "You are the judge," he said, and watched to see should I object, but I said nothing. He added to her, touching her sleeved forearm, that he prefers a gray flannel for this time of year. She said, "Yes, sir, I am sure. Shoes, too, of course," she surmised, "size 9. I nodded. And she turned away, stepped into the elevator. His door closed, and she descended. The double door to his suite was wide open to view before us, and entering the anteroom, the skyline of Chicago, a sweeping expanse, the lawn skirt on the shore and Lake Michigan beyond, was before us in a huge panoramic window. A stone-tiered terrace cascaded beyond it. The sun was splendid on the shivering waters. Sailboats tacked against the wind, charmed in a slow motion. He said he would take a nap and recommended I do the same. And I could not sleep, and I spent the next several hours going in and out of rooms or sitting, enchanted. On the lower patio, the city so far below me, I was no longer in my own life. The concierge, who was so beautiful and refined that I should think she was rich, brought me coffee with croissants and preserves. And within an hour, she brought me my suit for a fitting, a wispy tailor with sewing tape draped around his neck, flitting in on her perfumed trail. And my new hat in a box sat on the chintz sofa, a Borsellino fedora, a hat that would have cost me a whole paycheck. The shoes, a blazing black, so new they were, with shiny, slippery soles, had tassels on them, where laces ought to be. Were loafers, she said. Very smart, she said. Haywire arose, came out in a candy-striped silk robe and matching pajamas at about 11 o'clock, and I found that the concierge had somehow anticipated him and had made us cocktails in a silver shaker, which she poured into martini glasses with colossal onion-stuffed olives, skewered with frilly ornamental toothpicks. Steaks, medium rare, arrived shortly with baked stuffed potatoes, creamed peas with pearl onions. We took coffee and tiramisu on the terrace. I felt like he must have stole a bank. I could not help, but I asked him, "You ain't in any trouble, are you?" Haywire said, "If extravagance were wrong, there'd be no weddings. My thought is this, boy, celebrate life." He asked if I had napped, and I lied about it. He said the really good nightlife does not start until bars close, and that he expected we would not get any sleep until we got to the train tomorrow afternoon. He was right about that. The cabbie who took us to the Southside Chicago nightclub at 2 a.m. knew him just like the one in Minneapolis. And I remembered then that he never had stayed in the crew quarters during the Chicago layover on our Empire Builder runs. But I'd never thought much of it because Sam didn't either most of the time. A lot of men had women in the layovers or got drunk. And Haywire was a scamp, we all knew that. The club's neon sign was off, and the lights was turned off inside too. It looked to me like before Haywire didn't pay the cabbie, but the cabbie seemed glad to have seen him and promised to pick him up and take him to the train and said he'd get our bags for us from the Palmer House and see they were on the train. And Haywire just paused long enough to give him a warm squeeze on his shoulder and say, "Thanks for that, I'm beholden to you." The door to the club was opened for us even before we was out of the car. The bar itself was dark. The chairs turned up on tables there, and a morose nigra, mopping, looked at us miserably as we went by, led to the back room by a neat, short white man who was talking a wild string of phrases which made no sense to me. He parted a velvet curtain drawn across the back half of the place, which stood at the arched entrance to a wide room, an empty dance floor ahead, where sat a grand piano under a blue spot. A lean young nigra with a trumpet leaning in its curve, blowing out its spit valve, alone in that blue spot. And scattered before him, the same sort of empty round tables, chairs flipped over upside down on top of them, and a surrounding tier of plush booths built into the walls behind a polished brass rail. The velvet rope let down for the after-hours crowd. And except for a few of us, it was all niggers there, drinking whiskey in the dark. All gathered in the enormous curve of the back booth in the corner, overlooking the dance floor and stage area, the best seat in the house. And there, in the middle of it, in the crux of it, sat a little Negro man, natty dressed, horn-rimmed glasses, who'd caught my eye as I came in and nodded at Haywire to approach. The other Negroes around him, like his royal entourage, got up as we approached to make room for us, so I thought at first. But then I seen them collecting to the dance floor, where one went to sit at the piano, and another went behind him into the shadows and drew from the wall an upright bass, and the others got down chairs and sat in front of them. I seen then, as I was introduced to the man sitting in the booth, there was yet another man sitting away by himself, an older man than the others, alone. I noticed him only because another had brought him a highball. I instinctively knew he was sick. I instinctively knew he would not live much longer. I heard Haywire give my name to the man in the booth next to me, in an exchange that was entirely in French, or so I took it to be. Then he said to me, "This here is Billy Strayhorn," and the Negro with the horn-rimmed glasses said something warm to me, but I don't know what. I could not hear, because then the trumpeter began, and the piano came in chords without a cue, and the bass gave throated beats, and someone I had not even noticed, in a darker corner yet, another Negro there, started whispering on drums with wire brushes. Billy, as he told me to call him, urged me to sit up beside him, patted my leg, and Haywire sat in so close we was more intimate than I wanted. We listened. I had never heard this music. I did not know this music. I did not understand it. But I thought it was not music as I thought of music, not a dance, not a song, but a voice. I don't know how to say it. The way he played that horn, it talked, and talked a lot about the way I feel about you, things I do not know how to say and do not want to think too much about. You could talk that way, the way this man talked with his horn. That same full, warm, clear awareness, glory stabbing out of dark clouds, the wind up suddenly, a burst of birds away from me, especially in those words you said to me on those last days, when I thought it must be you was having a fever, and you smiling at me said, no, it was just that you was ready. I was not ready. Billy Strayhorn seen my face, what I was feeling, I think, and I felt his hand lay on my thigh, and while he caressed it a little, I understood it for kindness, though I did not know about him then what I know now. Haywire told me then the names of the others. The one on the trumpet was Miles Davis. On the piano, John Lewis, Art Blakey, drums, Oscar Pettiford on the upright. I asked, why do they call him Miles? I'd never heard that name before. Billy smiled, and Haywire nodded at him and turned to me and said, "I look at his eyes, man." I looked, and Haywire explained, "You can see for miles in them eyes." I looked, and Haywire added, "Or he can." "Yeah," I said, "I could see that." When the song, or whatever you might call it, came down to a quiet, gentle end, emptying softly into a sea of silence, Billy said, "Excuse me," and slipping along the empty side of the booth, he got out and went down to the dance floor, and Lewis got up from the piano as he approached, and the others, except the bass player Pettiford, took chairs at the tables in front of him, Miles leaning over, holding his trumpet, his elbows on his knees, looking at him with bloodshot eyes. Billy played the piano. The bass began to comment, and Billy began to sing. Haywire spoke aside to me as he sang. I heard them all together, and I cannot write what I experienced, but it was like I had four minds. The piano, the song sung, the words spoken, and the bass. Yes, the bass too. I cannot reproduce that, but you should know the song. I used to visit all the very gay places, those come what may places, where one relaxes on the axis of the wheel of life, to get the feel of life from jazz and cocktails. Haywire quietly explains, this is the song of life. The girls I knew had sad and sullen gray faces, with distant gay traces that used to be there. You could see where they'd been washed away by too many through the day. 12 o'clock tales. It has no parts, no refrains, no chorus. Then you came along with your siren song to tempt me to madness. I thought for a while that your poignant smile was tinged with the sadness of a great love for me. Ah, yes, I was wrong. Again, I was wrong. Life is lonely again, and only last year everything seemed so sure. Now life is awful again, a troughful of hearts could only be a bore. A week in Paris will ease the bite of it. All I care is to smile in spite of it. I'll forget you, I will, while yet you are still burning inside my brain. Romance is mush, stifling those who strive. I'll live a lush life in some small dive, and there I'll be while I rot with the rest of those whose lives are lonely too. Haywire looks at me a while I look back, stunned and speechless to it, and finishes his thoughts. Starts where it ends, ends where it begins. Opens up the door to you, leaves the door open behind, and walks away. The old man got up, and he came to the piano, and Billy helped him sit. They was taking turns. The old man began a contemplation. Miles got up and responded. They played Somewhere Over the Rainbow, and it was sad and moody at first. But then the drummer had a crazy idea, and they all went bebop and rolled into Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead, and everybody closed maniacally, and they all stopped on a skid, and everybody laughed out loud and talked about the mad sound and the riffs and the runs. Even in the blue light, the old man looked like a yellow turd, but he played like God, and the others worshipped him all night long. His name was Art Tatum, and I'd never heard of him before. When dawn came up, Miles had been in the bathroom for almost an hour before anyone went to look in on him, and it was Pettiford who said to Billy that he'd gone to lay down in the field of poppies. And Billy nodded, but I had not a clue what he meant. It wound down. John Lewis was caring for the old man and helping him to the front door to leave. Haywire then asked Billy to join us going to Washington, said it would do him good, and Billy said, "Why not?"
Froggy went a-courtin' and he did ride, uh-huh. Froggy went a-courtin' and he did ride, uh-huh. Froggy went a-courtin' and he did ride, a sword and a pistol by his side, uh-huh. He rode right up to Miss Mouse's door, uh-huh.
Let me in.
He rode right up to Miss Mouse's door, uh-huh. He rode right up to Miss Mouse's door and he hit it so hard that he made it roar, uh-huh.